Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It is the moment every war correspondent fears the most. A bomb blast or a spree of gunfire. An ambush. An attack. Suddenly, the people who are trying to cover the casualties in the conflict zone are casualties themselves. What happens in that moment? And what is the recovery like? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go more in-depth, talking about the story behind the story. And that's what we're going to share today. It's Thursday, March 17th, and several journalists have been killed in Ukraine this week. Documentarian Brent Renaud was shot dead Sunday. His colleague Juan Arredondo was injured. And then on Monday, a Fox News crew came under fire outside Kyiv. At first, we only knew that correspondent Benjamin Hall was injured. We heard that his crew members were missing, but did not report that out of deference to Fox, out of respect for the families. Then, on Tuesday, came the terrible confirmation that veteran Fox News cameraman Pierre Zakshevsky had been killed in the incident, along with producer Sasha Kuvshanova. Hall suffered severe injuries, and he has now been taken out of Ukraine. And there's a lot we don't know about his condition. And again, that's a matter for him and his family and the network, given his privacy. So they were working together trying to cover the war when they became casualties of the war. And it brought to mind other examples of American news crews caught in war zones. Kimberly Dozier was working for CBS back in 2006. She was on assignment on Memorial Day when she was nearly killed by a roadside bomb in Baghdad. That bomb took the lives of her two crew members, making her case eerily similar to Hall's case. "We were shredded by shrapnel," Dozier said, recalling that day. CBS cameraman Paul Douglas was killed. So was sound man James Brolin, along with Captain James Funkhauser of the Army, and an Iraqi translator known as Sam. Several American soldiers were also critically injured. Dozier came close to death and was in the hospital for months recovering. She later joined the AP. She is now a CNN global affairs analyst. You've probably seen her on the air many times. She's been with CNN for many years. And she's joining me here on the podcast to talk about the experience that Hall may be going through now and her own experience on that road to recovery. Kim, thanks for coming on the program. This has been an awful week for the news industry because so many people knew the Fox cameraman, knew the Ukrainian journalist, and know Benjamin Hall. And he was a State Department correspondent. That's his day job. So a lot of folks in D.C. Knew him and were working with him just weeks ago.
Yeah, I've been in briefings with him. He asks good, tough questions.
Yeah, and hopefully he'll be able to be back and doing that again soon. Mm. Given what you experienced in Baghdad, what crossed your mind first when you heard that he was injured? The first news we received was only about Ben because his crew members were missing. What did you think when you heard about it?
How is he going to feel when he wakes up? The confusion of trying to figure out what happened, where you are, and your immediate thought is also, where's my team? And I don't know if there was anyone around him who spoke English. I don't know. You're trying to piece together the memories that have been sliced by shock and pain, and then the realization that something's happened to you, and it's all like you scramble to put the story together of what just happened to sort of ground yourself. And at least when I woke up in Landstuhl, Germany, I had my family around me, and there were familiar faces who, you know, spoke my language and could explain what had happened to me. I don't know that Ben had that, because he would have woken up in a Ukrainian hospital.
Right, right. I remember you saying in the wake of your injuries that the hardest part of it was reliving parts you didn't remember. So practically everything in Iraq that day, right? Because you didn't wake up until you were in Germany.
Well, I talked to my rescuers at the scene. So I do remember the bomb blast going off, getting knocked into blackness, and then smelling what smelled like a thousand matches going off. It turns out a major component of the car bomb that hit us was sulfur. And then trying to figure out where Paul and James and why can't I get up? Because I didn't understand what had happened to my body. I didn't understand that I had both of my legs were broken and I could barely move. And then just listening to people calling for help around me and trying to figure out, do I need help? Because the shock sets in almost immediately and you feel pain, but it gets dulled and it's just really a sense of confusion and panic before your sort of body's survival instincts. One of the things that your body does is it gives you this sort of numb sense of well-being and calm, even in the midst of the pain. It's a survival mechanism from way back that I guess, you know, when we were grievously injured, it protects you from too much panic and fear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But over days, when I woke up, you know, it turns out I lost more than half my blood. And towards the end of when we were being treated at the bomb scene while they were trying to get us medevaced, I started fighting my rescuers because I was going hypoxic. That's what happens when you lose a certain amount of blood. And people watching that, soldiers watching that, thought that I was fighting. They thought maybe I was demanding VIP treatment or something. And I remember later reading that in a blog post and thinking, how could you think that? And also wondering, did I do that? And it wasn't until I talked to a trauma surgeon and they explained what happened to me. And then a year later, I got to meet the guy who tied the tourniquets on me, the National Guardsman who kept me alive. And he's like, yeah, Kim, that's when we knew we were about to lose you. So I'm thinking, so when I'm hearing all these first reports about Ben and his cameraman, Pierre, and his fixer, Sasha, we'll hear more of what actually happened when he's conscious and feels ready to talk about it. I spent a lot of time in the hospital bed trying to piece this stuff together, but every single day was it like a new medical drama. It was a long time before I wanted to talk to anyone about it, you know, in the outside world.
Right. Right. I would imagine. When did you find out that Paul and James had died?
The guys on the scene didn't tell me. James, our sound man, had been killed instantly. And Paul had traumatic injuries such that he died at the scene. And I realized later that he was one of the voices I heard calling for help, like my own voice, because I called for help too. Mm-hmm. And but that he passed away. And the National Guardsman, Jeremy Cope, later told me, in our training, you don't tell people at the scene who are in extremis that they've lost their colleagues. You know, you don't tell a soldier who you're patching up that he's the only survivor, because you want them focused on their own recovery and you don't want to give them another shock. So I didn't find out until I was operated on in Baghdad for several hours. Then they medevaced me to Balad, where they did head surgery and got the shrapnel out of my brain because they had a brain trauma center there. And then I got medevaced along with many wounded soldiers because it was a really bad time in Iraq and Afghanistan back in 2006 at that particular moment. So Launchdal was, every bed was filled. When I finally got to what was Bethesda Naval Hospital at the time, it's now renamed Walter Reed. Mm-hmm. Every bed was full there, but they didn't tell me until maybe 2 days in after I'd woken up in Launchdal. And one of my producers who had been, she was supposed to go that day, but there wasn't room for her in the Humvees. So she had flown to Germany and she broke the news, and it was crushing because yeah. I knew they both had wives, kids, and what I'm worried about for Ben is, you know, these are people who become like your family. You're on the road all the time in the most extreme situations. You're often like spending holidays together, Christmas and New Year, because especially in war zones, it always seems to be that way with the schedule. And I just started scrambling in my brain to think, you know, what's Paul's wife's name? I think James was married. Oh my gosh, why am I still here? Are their families going to hate me? And that, after all the physical recovery and, you know, I had post-traumatic stress for about 5 weeks. And that's everything from nightmares, hypervigilance, flashbacks. But I didn't develop the disorder, which is when PTS, which is the body's way of processing trauma, when it lasts longer than 6 weeks and becomes just regular and interferes with your daily life, that's when a disorder is diagnosed. But what lasted much longer, years, 10 years, was the survivor's guilt. And that's where I'm really thinking about Ben right now, when he wakes up and someone breaks this to him.
Right. Something that's so out of your control. It sounds like in your case and maybe in Benji's case, we don't know. It's as simple as, you know, what side of a vehicle you sat down in or what direction the car was turning. It's something so random.
Yeah. In our case, it was the proximity that we all happened to be to the car bomb that was parked near the T-stand where we'd gone to interview people. And it just happened to be that Paul and James were closer to the car bomb. They were about 10 feet away and I was about 20 feet away. So, and two of the soldiers with us both lost limbs. Captain Alex Funkhauser, the captain we were filming, it was his patrol. He was also killed instantly, like James Broland, our sound man. And so one of the things that happens in an incident like this is you have had all control taken from you. I mean, to work in a conflict zone where something bad might happen to you at any time, every time you go out, you're trying to minimize the risks as much as possible, but there's another sort of armor that you take with you, and it's the idea that it won't happen to me. And once it does, you spend a lot of time trying to figure out every detail in the run-up. Like, could I have foreseen this happening? Was there a warning that I should have seen beforehand? Did I ignore my spidey sense? You have a million questions because it's a way of trying to regain back control. Because if you can figure out what you screwed up that allowed this horrible nightmare to happen, then you can avoid doing it and avoid having a nightmare happen again. And as I was to find out talking to counselors in Bethesda Naval Hospital where I was treated, and then afterwards, because this is something I really struggled with, they said that it was every single soldier in every single hospital bed who had lost buddies. They were doing the same thing that I was, waking up at 3 a.m., having nightmares about your team, sobbing your eyes out. and asking why me, and also trying to figure out what exactly happened and what could I have done. One of the stages you go through in grief also is blame. And so some of my CBS colleagues and found reasons to blame me just because I was alive. Oh. And I blamed myself. Now, there was no way I could have known that there was going to be an Al-Qaeda car bomb planted on that street waiting for a U.S. patrol. I mean, look, this wasn't about us. And Paul and James and I had discussions the night before about the shoot, because I wanted to always make sure that my team, I used to be the radio person who would hitch a ride with them in other conflict zones before I started doing TV. So I really respected, like the cameraman, the Fox cameraman, Pierre, who was lost in Ben's incident. They have wisdom and they have that instinct that you want to pay attention to. And if anyone in your team tells you, I don't feel good about this, you don't go down that road.
Right.
And none of us had seen this one coming. Obviously, I don't know Ben well, and I'm projecting, but I'm thinking that is what he's going to torture himself with for days and weeks and months as he's fighting through his own recovery. And I've already heard a few of us who've been hit in the field, like there was an instant sort of network of reaching out to each other, because it also reminds you what happened to you. But, we all know what a long, awful journey he's starting. And a friend in particular who, I don't want to talk about what we think Ben's injuries are because I don't want to invade his privacy.
Right.
But there are injured journalists who already are planning, they've reached out to his family so that when he's ready, they can talk to him to try to help him avoid some of the stuff that we went through.
Well, let's take people behind the scenes a little bit about how this works. Because
the privacy thing also, it's a weird situation. All of a sudden, you're not telling the story. You are the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to hate brilliant news photographers with really long lenses who caught shots of me as I was being wheeled onto a medical plane from Landstuhl going back to the States.
Mm.
Because they got the pictures of me on this mobile ICU with all of these like bags hanging off of me and tubes in my nose and my face bruised and bloodied and with stitches in my forehead. And I understand the world wanted to see that, but I didn't want the world to see it.
Right.
I was trying to go to ground. So I was glad that like the hospital in the States had to have a plan to keep reporters off the floor, away from all of us, but especially me, because at that point, there hadn't been a woman correspondent injured, and it was, it was Memorial Day, which is kind of generally a slow news day. So it became really big news, at least for a couple weeks after the attack.
It did, and thankfully, episodes like this are relatively rare. There are sadly many more local journalists injured and killed in war zones. To have an American correspondent, you, Kim, or Bob Woodruff at ABC, or now Benjamin Hall at Fox, be grievously injured in a war zone is thankfully rare. But the fact that it's happened, again and again and again, whether in Iraq now in Ukraine, it does underscore the risks. I want to tell people a little bit about the backstory about Ben, but first, what did Woodruff say to you? How did he? I remember he eased your guilt because he had been injured in Iraq earlier in 2006, and he said something to you that was important.
Yeah. Well, he said that, look, Kim, Paul and James would not have wanted you to feel guilty, because by feeling guilty, you took away or are taking away their choice. They chose to be there. They were doing the jobs they loved, and give them that and stop taking on that choice that they made. And it really did help. Cause it reminded me that, you know, we were three professional news people. We were equals. Now from the point of view of the TV watching public, you only see the correspondent, but the ideal team in the field, especially in a conflict zone, you're all watching each other's backs. You're all counting on each other's experience to get you through whatever particular nightmare you're covering.
Yeah.
I also have to mention, so Bob was injured 4 months to the day before I was, and he was still in the hospital recovering when I got injured, and his wife, Lee Woodruff, got on the phone with my parents when they were still in Landstuhl and advised them to go to Bethesda Naval Hospital because she had been hearing in the waiting rooms from some of the injured, the loved ones of the injured who were also there, about conditions at Walter Reed. And I don't know if people listening will all remember, but Walter Reed had some really bad issues with organization and treatment of troops. And so she got on the phone with my parents and said, she has to go to Bethesda. So again, it's the network of people who've gone through this, trying to help others through it. And one of the most helpful things for me too, was when I was in the hospital and they were still trying to reconstruct my legs, because I got shrapnel to the brain, both eardrums blown out, bilateral femur fractures, the two long bones in the leg were broken, and I had first to third degree burns from my hips to my ankles, and basically some chunks of my leg missing. And sorry, that's gross, but that's just what happens when
reality.
Large explosives go off right next to you. And a colonel who'd had the same injuries but was much further along in his recovery came and visited me and showed me the after. He's like, okay, here's what my leg looks like. Here's what the scars look like. And, you know, I know right now you can't even picture standing up because I had to learn to walk again. And it took 3.5 months to get to that point where I could finally, you know, walk 10 steps. And then graduation was walking 100 feet with a cane. But it was every day in that hospital bed feels like an eternity. And so that gets back to, it was a lot of time to think about why am I here and why did fate choose that I would end up surviving in this situation and my friends are gone.
Mm. And as you said, Kim, you know, we are respecting Hall's privacy and Fox's privacy to give folks a sense behind the scenes of, you know, of how something like this happens. You know, the typical rivalries melt away instantly. Networks help each other. News divisions help each other. And other news divisions don't break news about the people that are affected. And what I mean by that is, you know, when Hall was reported injured, we knew he had crew members with him. We knew that Pierre and Sasha were with him. I didn't know their names at first, but I knew there were crew members with him and that they were reported missing. And Fox purposely didn't share that initially, while there was an attempt made to find them and find out if they were still alive. There was a window of time where there was this hope that maybe somehow they were still alive. But my point is, you didn't have other networks going out reporting that. You don't get ahead of Fox and what Fox is going to share. And I think that was true in your case. I remember that was true in the case of Woodruff, where reporters, you know, I was a blogger back then writing a blog called TV Newser, and I knew about Woodruff before ABC announced it. Everybody waited until the network announced it. And so the same is true now when it comes to Hall with regards to, you know, what his condition is and what exact his injuries are. The good news we know as of now, as we're taping this on here on Thursday, is that he is out of Ukraine and he's said to be in good spirits, according to Fox, and on the road to recovery. But that road's going to be long. And as you speak here, I'm thinking about aspects of that recovery that would never occur to me. It's something that never fully ends.
Well, because just in this initial stage, I mean, because now a few of us have gone through this from different networks and news outlets, we do all now know that one of the hard things is the family's got to stay near the hospital, because one of the force multipliers for healing is to have your loved ones around you. And you need them by your side as much as they can stand it. Especially sometimes when my family was able to stay overnight, because the nights are the worst. The staff at any hospital is always lower at night, and that's when temperatures tend to spike and you get extra pain, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And to have your family there to run and get the nurse for you, or to get the ice chips for you, et cetera, is really helpful. So already the State Department's Correspondents Association has taken up a collection, which has been shared among a few news outlets, for getting the family meals. Because, yes, you can eat at the hospital's cafeteria, but that gets old after a while. and also just being stuck in the hospital week after week for family members gets old. And so we're all thinking about, you know, Rhoda's on making sure that, you know, I'm sure Fox will learn this quickly and the hard way, but they'll have to support the family that's supporting Ben as he goes through this.
Right. That's a great,
I know that also the military fraternity is already going into gear, getting in touch with Fox to reach out to him so that someone like that colonel who visited me to show me what the after looks like will visit Ben to let him know, you know, that there is, there's a light at the end of this, what seems like interminable tunnel in the healing and the multiple surgeries that it often takes to deal with war wounds.
And on that
last
note,
injuries are messy. And, there can be secondary infections. Almost everyone I know who went through this had a secondary infection afterwards in the hospital that took, you know, some serious and severe treatment. So, you know, his family's about to run a marathon too.
Mm. Yes, and that's true for Juan Arredondo as well, who I mentioned in the introduction, the filmmaker who was wounded on Sunday. You know, it's been just an awful week, and there's this growing sense that Russia may be targeting journalists in the war zone. So as we wrap up this part of the conversation, Kim, you know, you mentioned you're thinking about going down a road. Everybody in the team is going to agree. If anyone has any hesitation, you're going to back away. That has happened many times in Ukraine in the past few weeks. These are the untold stories of war correspondents in Ukraine, folks making very careful choices about where to go and where not to go. So that's happening every day. But viewers and readers don't know it. They don't always see it or hear it. So let's just, you know, maybe underscore that this is not daredevil reporting. People are not out there taking risks in order to get crazier videos that they can show off on their Instagram. These trips and this reporting, this is carefully thought through ahead of time.
Yes. And we often, if you have the resources for it, have security advisors along with us who have, in our case in Iraq, they were former British special operators who would help us gauge a situation and say, okay, I know you guys used to go to the bookseller's street and spend 2 hours there interviewing people, but now there are insurgents who are well armed and it'll take them about 15 minutes to clock that you've entered a certain neighborhood and to go back to wherever they've stored their weapons and then come back and attack you. So I want you to think about now only spending 15 minutes in a certain area. So in Ukraine, journalists, security advisors, if they have them, they'll be sharing. There's a lot of cooperation in the field in terms of, you know, maybe our bosses wouldn't like to know how much of it there is, but there's like this group of maybe 500 international journalists who show up, who get assigned to these different awful stories. And we all know each other. And if you hear like, oh, ABC News has no water, you share some of yours. Oh, if we got attacked on this street, it seems a Russian like soldier's nest has moved in there. You let other people know. And also the security advisors all keep the grapevine going with each other. But the thing is, the reason why you have to keep leaving the confines of the, well, so-called safe hotel in Ukraine with the strikes on civilian targets, nothing is really safe. But we're hearing from the officials on both sides about how the war is going, how the morale is, how the casualties figures are. And you've got to try to get out and verify some of this for yourself. So, you know, in this case, not so much from the Russian side with the way that they have been attacking after a few days, you know, in the initial parts of the invasion. Matthew Chance was able to interview some and that he accidentally stumbled across that he thought were Russian soldiers. But now it seems like they've decided to attack journalists, perhaps because they're a symbol of the West. We can't know why. But it means that your view of what's going on is going to shrink if you're limited in where you can go. Yeah. But you try to get out there to see what are the Ukrainian troops or those irregular forces going through in the trenches? How's their morale? What kind of casualties are they taking? Or perhaps you could get with a crew that was launching one of those new Switchblade drones that are being deployed from the U.S. at some point. You know, that's the kind of thing that can show Americans or the world, show people not in the conflict zone, what's being done in their name, what's being done to the Ukrainians, what's being done to the people who can't escape the situation and how it's being carried out. You got to take that risk.
Right. A calculated risk in order to get the news out to the world. On that note, quick break here on the Reliable Sources podcast and more about that with Kimberly Dozier right after this.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And we're back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Kimberly Dozier, CNN Global Affairs Analyst. Before the break, we were talking about the importance of going there, of being in the war zone, taking those calculated risks and getting the news out. How are you, Kim, learning about the war zone yourself? What outlets are you relying on right now? How are you making your assessments of the situation? You know, what are you reading? What are you watching?
So my morning pattern is I record CNN. So I watch, the first thing I listen to is the BBC World Service, because they've got so many people around the world, but they also have a huge language service. So I listen to some of their reports, and then I rewind to the top and I listen to what's the latest coming out of CNN, because we have so many teams on the ground. I read the two wire services. And then after I get that sort of foundation, I start pulsing my networks of European diplomats, intelligence officers I've met over the years, some who are in Europe, some who are in Washington, trying to pulse what they're hearing, you know, what's Putin's mood. I also look at a lot of the Ukrainian social media. What has Zelensky posted? Try to see if I can find a translation of his entire remarks. And there are a number of think tank experts who I have, you know, collected on Twitter, who I see, okay, has anyone overnight written an analysis of how Putin is using his military forces and how it's different than their normal doctrine? You know, real kind of geeky national security stuff, so that I can try to get in the heads of what the Russian military commanders might do next, and how the Ukrainians are responding.
And so as we tape this on, again, it's Thursday, March 17th, how would you describe the state on the ground? I feel like half the time as I'm scrolling through Twitter or I'm watching television, I come away with the impression that the Ukrainians have the upper hand despite this incredible, awful, you know, battering by the Russians. And then it's just as easy to view it and say, well, the Russians are slowly but surely squeezing the life out of Ukraine. I guess I'm suggesting that you could take away different assessments based on the same news coverage.
Well, I was definitely in the Russians are going to win, they're slowly squeezing the life out of Ukraine camp, until a British defense report in the past 24, 48 hours or so, Britain's defense intelligence arm reported that the Russians are taking such severe losses that they're having to round up new soldiers to bring in from across Russia. And they're also taking severe losses in terms of equipment. And I thought, oh, wait. Then I heard from a Pentagon official that 75% of Russia's tactical battalions, these are the ground combat forces that have been doing most of the fighting, 75% of those are deployed in Ukraine. So they only have another 25% to draw from. That's a severe shortage of manpower. And it seems like the Ukrainians might be causing him enough pain that at least they're going to reduce the speed. The problem is, we also today have a report as we're recording this that there is a Russian ship movement from the Pacific headed in this direction. So that's going to take some time. That tells us that Putin is in this for the long haul. He seems to be moving either men or materiel in this direction for a protracted fight. Mm. My concern is that the public's attention will move away from Ukraine. The images are already starting to look, sadly, still horrible, but the same. And I went through the same in the Iraq War, where I ran out of new ways to tell an awful story. And the American public got image fatigue. And we found that if we put a story from Iraq in the top 3 minutes of the newscast, people would change the channel. And so it got really hard to get into the top segment of the newscast, partly because of that effect, that you know, the producers back in the States were aware of. But also partly because, you know, after you've reported on a car bomb that killed 100 people, you know, is a car bomb that kills 10 people as newsworthy anymore? That's a horrible thing to say. But, you know, the brain after a bit gets numb to the awful violence. And that's what happened in Syria. So ignorance and getting tired of the war helps Putin if he's able to just grind onward. The best possible thing that could happen for the survival of Ukraine is that they have a sort of a Bosnia moment. Reporters of a certain age, like me, remember when Christian Amanpour stood up to President Bill Clinton and asked him, you know, how he could just stand by and let people get slaughtered by the ethnic cleansing that was going on. And that was one of the things that galvanized U.S. involvement. I'm wondering, how far does Russia have to go? How horrible do the attacks have to be before NATO, the Biden administration consider, okay, we're going to take the risk of World War III by establishing a no-fly zone because this is unjust and this will not stand. But we're not at that point yet, and we may never be. And if we don't get there, I'm afraid that Russia will slowly be allowed to obliterate Ukraine, literally.
Mm. War fatigue. You called it image fatigue. That's a unique version of that phrase, where it's seeing the same images over and over again can be numbing.
Yeah.
I'd like to think it's different in the Instagram and TikTok age. Maybe it's not. Maybe people get numb even more quickly. But I wonder, compared to, let's say, 2003 in Iraq, is it possible that because we're experiencing this war through our phones, our smartphones, through these scrolling feeds, and maybe it feels closer to us all as consumers? Maybe it registers as more real and even more heartbreaking?
I
don't know. That's just a thought bubble, honestly.
Yeah, no, you're definitely onto something. The way also that Ukrainians are very social media savvy, very creative, and they're posting things in a way that get people's attention. Look what President Zelensky did by surprising everyone when he made that address to Congress, showing that video in the middle of his speech that he knew would be carried by all U.S. networks, and having images in that video that we would probably not put on our air, graphic images of war. And that's, in a way, it's being more honest with the public by showing them how horrible it is. But it was a way that shocked people. And I'm wondering how much of seeing that video helped fuel President Biden's decision to say this week that Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. That's the kind of thing that can keep the attention on and galvanize action when we understand how horrible war is, when we see the unsanitized bloody nightmare.
And to bring this conversation full circle, it was a Fox News correspondent who shouted that question to Biden that yes. caused him to turn around and say, yes, war criminal. Kim, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I know it cannot be easy to recount your own experience in the war zone, but I think we all benefit from it. Thank you.
Thank you. And thoughts and prayers for Ben, his family, and Pierre and Sasha's families.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this week. We will see you on television this Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. Thanks for tuning in.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.